Okay, our last speaker is Lindsay Hill. She is a researcher, also with the National Center for Homelessness Among Veterans. She received her bachelor's degree in psychology from Penn State. I guess that makes you the black sheep kind of the crowd at the center, right? Everybody else is from UPenn. So. Her research interests focus primarily on homelessness, public health, and mental health service utilization.
Good afternoon. So today I'm going to be talking about a pilot study that was conducted here in the DC area in the HUD-VASH program. To start, I have no relationships to disclose. I'm not making money off of homelessness. I don't know anyone that does. So to give you an overview of what I'm going to go into today, first, I'd like to give you kind of a background on the HUD-VASH program. It's been kind of mentioned a little bit today by the other presenters, but I'll give you a little bit more of a background. I'm going to talk about there's two very common approaches to permanent supportive housing. So I'll mention the high-demand model and the housing-first low-demand models, give you some idea of where they're similar and where they're different. And I'll also specifically give you some information on the DC HUD-VASH pilot, what it was, how it came to be. And I'll discuss some preliminary findings from what we've found from the pilot and next steps for data analysis. So HUD-VA Supportive Housing is a collaborative effort between the VA and HUD. And in this collaboration, HUD provides the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher. And the VA provides the case management services. And this program is designed to target the most vulnerable, chronically homeless veterans. And the goal of the program is to help veterans and their families exit homelessness and fully reintegrate into the community of their choosing. So the veteran has a choice of where they get to live. It's mostly contingent on a landlord's approval to accept the voucher. And also, the unit needs to pass certain inspection criteria that's established by HUD and the Public Housing Authority. So currently, there are over 37,500 HUD-VASH vouchers distributed nationally. This map gives you kind of a view by state where all the vouchers are. There are some additional project-based vouchers that aren't included in this map. So I'd like to take a step back for a moment and give you a definition of what chronic homelessness is. Like I said, HUD-VASH is designed to target these people. A chronically homeless person is a person with a disabling condition, usually a serious mental illness or some very disabling medical condition that's a physical disability or a chronic condition. And it's a person who's been homeless either for 1 year or more continuously, or a person who has been homeless four or more times in the last 3 years. So it's kind of this frequent homelessness that's occurring. And chronic homelessness is also characterized by unemployment or a lack of income, incarceration history, a high utilization of the shelter systems, and also a high utilization of expensive medical care services. So a lot of inpatient hospitalizations and emergency room visits. So there's two common approaches to permanent supportive housing. There's the high demand models and the housing first low demand models. The above slide gives you a brief comparison of the two models. Historically, the VA has followed a more high-demand approach. And in a high-demand model, it usually requires the veteran to be housing-ready. And by this, we mean they need to be clean and sober before they can enter housing. They're usually required to go through some kind of treatment program. In contrast, housing first and low demand does not require that a person meet these criteria before they enter housing. High-demand models also require participation in services, so either like treatment groups or case management services, whereas a housing-first low-demand does not require participation in these services. It only requires The only requirements it places on an individual are those within the normal conditions of being a tenant. So they hold the lease. They're required to abide by the terms of their lease. And usually they do agree to weekly home visits from a case manager. And high demand leases usually contain some addenda that requires services. Whereas in a housing first, low demand, the individual holds the lease and their housing is not contingent on their treatment compliance. So the key thing to remember to kind of contrast these two models are, in high demand, treatment and housing are kind of seen as going hand in hand. You need to really have the treatment to keep the housing, to maintain that stability. Whereas in housing first, it's really separated. It's more focused on housing stability, and the treatment is kind of seen as another issue that's outside of the housing issue. In DC, there was a lot of political will that drove reducing homelessness in the DC metro area, as well as in the nation. It's been a priority at both the federal and the local levels. The DC initiative occurred because the White House and other federal partners prioritized ending homelessness in DC. And as a result, the city of DC created a 10-year plan to end homelessness. And the DC Department of Human Services, which is abbreviated as DCDHS, was given the task of reducing homelessness in DC. And they decided to embrace a housing first, low demand approach in their philosophy. And a meeting occurred between the VA, the DCDHS, and other key community partners. And in this meeting, it was decided to expand the HUD-BASH program to help more veterans that are homeless in the DC area. And this expansion was called HUD-BASH Plus. And a portion of the fiscal year 2009 voucher allocations were to set aside to be contracted to DCDHS. As a community partner, they would administer that other portion of the vouchers. And the vouchers were implemented in 2010. So what we had were 105 of those vouchers were administered by DCDHS, and they used a housing first, high demand model. And 70 of the vouchers were administered by the VA Medical Center, and they used kind of their standard high demand model. And the goal of this pilot was to target and rapidly house the most vulnerable chronically homeless veterans. So those are the two things they would be measured on, how they're targeting, and also how quickly are they getting these individuals into housing. And this slide is giving you a little comparison of how the vouchers were administered at the two locations, but by the two partners. There was minimal outreach in the VA. Veterans usually present for their services. Whereas DCDHS did a little more targeting. They used a vulnerability index, which was developed by Pathways to Housing. And the supportive services on the VA side were administered by VA case management staff, whereas the DCDHS partners used their own case managers. The interesting thing about these groups is neither one of them required sobriety before somebody could enter the program. However, the VA did stress that they put a focus on families with women and children. And in the VA, the case manager usually assists with the housing search. So, that housing search doesn't start until after the voucher has been issued. So there are a couple steps that occur before that where the veteran's admitted into HUD-BASH, and there's a lot of paperwork required to get a voucher. Like you have to have a birth certificate, you have to have certain things that homeless people don't always have. So they sometimes have to spend a lot of time gathering those documents. And DHS maintained a database of pre-inspected apartments, and they actually didn't wait for the housing search to begin. They did it as soon as the person was entered. So usually lease signing was also the same day that the voucher was issued. And DCDHS also leveraged some resources to provide some flexible funding for security deposits, first month's rent, and also some furniture for the veterans. So the methods for evaluating the pilot, the VA and DHS completed the same administrative paperwork at referral, admission, housing progress updates, and also every 90 days they completed a case management report. And the analysis today is very preliminary. It's just some descriptive statistics, some t-tests, chi-squares for significance. And here's a snapshot of the demographics of the two groups. You can see the Housing First group, the mean age was a little bit higher than in the high-demand VAs group, but it wasn't significant. And the gender group was interesting. The Housing First group served a much larger proportion of men than women. And part of that is because in the high-demand model, the VA did say they were going to try to target women more. Ethnicity-wise, Housing First, they targeted a slightly larger percentage of African Americans, but it wasn't significant. And also, marital status was a little interesting. There were more never married people in the Housing First group than in the high demand group. Another, we looked at the military service history, and a significantly larger proportion of veterans served in Housing First were Vietnam and post-Vietnam era veterans. This kind of ties together with the average age. Generally, those individuals are going to be older. They also show up the most when you're looking at, you know, who's homeless. And corrections history was particularly interesting. The Housing First group had a much higher proportion of people that had had a lifetime history of having some corrections, like had some jail time, basically. Also with employment, the Housing First group had a larger percentage of veterans who within the 3 years that they were referred to the program had no employment. So they really just didn't have a lot of income, these individuals. So to kind of give an overall to digest all these demographics, when we talk about targeting, the Housing First group did serve a much older cohort, and it also served a much less financially stable one with more criminal justice issues. This slide shows the housing stability of veterans at program referral. A slightly higher percentage of veterans in the Housing First group would be considered chronic based on their homeless frequency. And to be considered chronic, they had to have four or more episodes of homelessness within the 3 years of referral. And under homeless duration, a significantly larger proportion of veterans in the Housing First group met criteria for chronic homeless. And to meet that criteria in the duration category, you had to be continuously homeless for a year or longer. And overall, the Housing First group served a larger percentage of chronically homeless veterans, 74%, compared to the VA's housing or high demand group, which was 63%. It wasn't significant, but you can still kind of visually see that there's a little bit better targeting going on with the community partner in DCDHS. This slide shows the diagnostic vulnerabilities of veterans at program referral. There were no statistically significant results here, but there are some very interesting differences that we saw. The Housing First group had a slightly higher incidence of psychiatric diagnoses at referral. And even larger, the DHS Housing First group had a much higher percentage of medical problems. When you compare it to the VA's high-demand group. The VA looked like they were targeting more substance abuse users, which kind of goes along with that high-demand, you know, treatment-ready, housing-ready approach. And although I didn't create a slide, it's also worth noting that 68% of the Housing First veterans were determined to be in need of medical treatment at the time of referral, whereas only 49% of the VA veterans were. So it really looked like the Housing First group was targeting a medically sicker population than what the VA was. And finally, we did a comparison of the time of placement into housing from referral to move-in, and this is in days. The Housing First group had a significantly reduced average lease-up time of 45 days compared to the VA's high-demand system, which was 204 days. So I don't need to say that was significant. And some reasons for this may be that the DCDHS had these pre-inspected apartments. They had a whole database of apartments that were already approved by the PHA for move-in. The veterans didn't have to take it. That's what the Housing Choice Voucher is for. They can always say, no, none of these meet what I want. Let's look elsewhere. But a lot of the veterans did take advantage of this. They also employed a housing specialist who had more of a relationship with the PHA and kind of took some of that housing search burden away from the case manager. And also, at the time of voucher issue, the lease signing occurs for the DHS group. So you have people that already have their apartment lined up as they're coming to get their voucher. So it really shortens and condenses that system. So it's not a step system, it's just a continuous process. In contrast, the VA may have admitted veterans from transitional programs, and that kind of shows when you saw the higher incidence of substance use people in their group. So they may have been referred to HUD-VASH, but they were waiting for them to get through their treatment services before they could move on and get them their voucher. So that really adds time to their process. And also the housing search for the VA usually doesn't happen until after the voucher is issued. So to summarize these preliminary findings, there's considerable evidence that Housing First can be implemented in the VA successfully, and also that it met its two primary goals. It had better targeting of the vulnerable, chronically homeless. It was an older population. It was a population that had an incarceration history, unemployment, much higher percentage of chronic, and also a high medical need. It also demonstrated rapid placement into housing. Veterans were housed on average within 45 days of referral, and the VA process took a lot longer. Next steps for this evaluation, we have additional data. We're going to explore differences in the case management, looking more at the frequency of visits, things like that, to see if those groups really differed. We're also going to look at outcomes 1 year after the move-in. We're really interested in housing stability. Are they still housed 1 year after their move-in? I can say that preliminarily, 89% of the Housing First veterans are still housed with the HUD-VASH voucher 1 year after they've moved in. We're also going to look at any changes in employment or income. Has that being housed also, help them gain access to more services to increase their income or help them get some employment? And we'll also look at service utilization. Are there any reductions in their unscheduled hospitalizations, any reductions in emergency room visits? This will really demonstrate that it's cost-worthy to have a program like this. In addition, there's also a larger-scale HUD-VASH Housing First pilot underway at the VA. This pilot consists of 14 participating VA medical centers, and these medical centers are all over the country. The pilot will be evaluated on a program level, so we'll look at are they really adhering to Housing First in that model, and they'll also be evaluated on the veteran level, so what is the satisfaction that the veteran has with the services, and also are they targeting correctly, are they targeting the vulnerable, are they getting them leased up? These are all performance measures that we're going to look at in this pilot. So in conclusion, the DC pilot provided a unique opportunity to explore the feasibility of Housing First and HUD-VASH. Many VA medical centers are embracing the Housing First approach as a model that will better serve veterans. I think that's it.
Okay. Are there any questions out there? Great. First one.
I can't believe, but it's amazing to me on many different levels how significant homelessness is in regards to public health issues. And to get on my soapbox, the APHA has really not shined a light on this issue at their annual meetings, and it's unfortunate that that's the case. Second of all, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand why, how significant the veteran homeless issue is, especially in regards to families and the females. And this is not going to go away, and it continues to escalate. And to me, it's kind of interesting. They say services are available, they want to end homelessness in 5 years, but accessing the services and providing a blanket of services to those that most need it are really problematic for this population. And, for example, in San Diego, where they have a weekend event, they can only help a handful of vets, and the rest have to be turned away because the services just don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And until we shine a light on this, until we get our partners to say we need to do something about this, we're going to be picking at it, and it's not going to go away, and it's going to become more significant. And from a public health aspect, that's inexcusable.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get up, Mike.
So, and for the recording, I don't know that I can summarize that effectively, but we just had a very eloquent description of sort of the current situation and the problem,
and I probably should tell
the complexity of it. And where are you? Yeah.
I'm the public health officer for Orange County, California.
Oh, okay.
And we have a significant homeless population.
Mm-hmm.
We're now addressing families and providing wraparound services to make them successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just not housing, it's everything.
Mm-hmm.
And providing those services for success in order for them to move on is absolutely critical. And yes, in Orange County, we do have a
Well, there's so many different ways to get started answering what you said. I'm going to take moderator privilege and answer first, and then defer to Dr. Metro. So specific to that, actually, I don't know if any of you got to see, the first question was just that APHA, again for the recording, that APHA does not take as strong a stance on homelessness as some of its other key issues. If you guys got to see the keynote, the very first talk was Dr. Georges Benjamin, who's on sabbatical but came in just to introduce the very first speaker. And the very first thing he said was housing is a human right. And I turned to my friend that I was sitting with and said, I got him. We have him on record now. Because, you know, APHA has a history of being out in front of a lot of causes, and him saying that makes a big difference. And it is a tone shift, because 10 years ago, they wouldn't have said that at APHA. They would have said healthcare is a human right back then. But now we know that those things are so closely interrelated that you can't do healthcare without housing. It doesn't work. Street medicine has its place and is important, but until we get into this idea that housing is related to health and that those things are not separatable, I think we're not going to move forward. And I've been making that point pretty heavily, and your timing for that question is great, because I've spent the last 4 days working with some of the other researchers here at the conference, and we've got a work group together to review the current policies by APHA, and we're going to be trying to narrow the gap between what we know to be what we should be advocating for and where we are now. APHA has a history. When the great thing about the way policies work and their voice works is that the community and the scientists that are the members of APHA get to decide what those policies are. And then the advocates in the Legislative Affairs Office are entirely beholden to what we tell them is the best science. It's not like another group where they can hedge and say, oh, well, we could say this, but we better not push for this cause because it's not politically, you know, savvy or whatever. It doesn't work that way at APHA. We say it, and then they have to go to the Hill and say that that's what we want. And that's why APHA ends up in the front so often, is because there's nobody telling us that we can't advocate for that. So when I looked up the policies in the first place a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, I've been in this position as chair of this caucus for 2 years, and my first response was to say, well, why the hell don't we have something like this? And then I realized that was our fault. So we're taking steps to change that.
Just to give you an example, and then unfortunately, I'll be more than happy to help with this issue.
Uh-huh.
My assignment.
Good. So yeah, then you'll get an email in the next couple of weeks.
What was interesting 3 years ago in Orange County, I was asked by a public health nurse to visit the Armory in Santa Ana.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in there, and there were 200 people. There were 200 mats on the floor,
mm-hmm.
and there were 50 children walking around.
Wow.
And when I asked, what's this all about, they said, this is just the way it's been.
Hmm.
And as a pediatrician and as a father seeing 50 children in that cold weather shelter,
mm-hmm.
being subjected to what's happening in that shelter is, to me, just heart-wrenching.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward to now, it's been 2 years where there hasn't been a single family or child in that armory, and they've all been diverted
mm-hmm.
into housing, a motel, and have wraparound services. So my point in telling this story is, until we shine a spotlight, a shining spotlight on this issue, nothing's going to be done in a way that we can really make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my personal belief, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
I appreciate that very much. Yeah. Do you want to come up and say something about that?
I don't have a whole lot more to add to that. I mean, I agree with basic what you're saying. I will put in a pitch for the VA is that the VA has increased the resources for addressing this problem. One good example is what Lindsay's talking about is the HUD dash and how the number of housing units has really expanded. How they've looked at non-traditional veteran populations such as families.
Come up and say this into the microphone. That's my job as moderator, just make sure you're on record.
Real quick, things like HUD dash, how they've looked at non-traditional vet populations such as families, how they've expanded, also have taken a tack at looking at prevention and instituting in their pilot programs, with their pilot programs that are slated to expand, looking at identifying risk factors, especially among people returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, and basically focusing on heading off homelessness and rehousing them rapidly, kind of in the model of the HPRP program. So there is progress being made. I mean, if you know anything about the VA is like an aircraft carrier in that it takes a lot to get it to change direction in either way. So again, what Lindsay was talking about in terms of this kind of a culture shift from this kind of continuum-based, the high-demand type of housing that the VA has been traditionally been oriented and getting a more housing first, this kind of approach to where it doesn't matter, you know, it's getting housing is priority and then we look at what the rest of the service needs are rather than the other way around. Something like that happens a lot more quickly in the mainstream community than it does in the VA community. So a lot of need, I certainly agree with you there, but I would argue too that the VA has done for, if you know the VA, just the changes that they've made have also been, to me anyway, very impressive.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Ben, I was hoping if you can just, if we got a couple, any other questions?
Yeah.
There
we go.
Yes, sir.
This is very mundane compared to the last conversation, but I would appreciate, just Lindsay Hill could just clarify some of the contrasts in the very interesting slide about number of days to placement. And I want to know a couple of things. Is placement in independent housing, where people are looking after themselves? Is that what you mean by
mm-hmm.
placement? Okay. And so 203 days for the high demand. Most of those people were in sort of temporary housing.
They most likely were.
You could to repeat the question first.
Okay.
I know.
So we wanted to know that 203 days that it took to be leased up, you know, where were they during that time? I don't believe so. I actually don't have the data on that. It's one of the questions that we did ask them. That's why I said it was preliminary. I have a feeling, looking at the substance abuse data, that a lot of them were probably in some kind of transitional housing during that time, which also adds to that length because they have to complete that whole process before they can move on to the permanent supportive housing.
Yeah, anecdotally, guys I know in Philadelphia, that's kind of where they are. They're kind of languishing almost in treatment programs and in other transitional housing programs and just kind of waiting for all
basically all the bureaucracy and stuff to clear so they can move into housing. That seems to take forever.
Yeah, could you also clarify the definition of high demand? That's kind of an interesting term. So.
High demand, it's also called housing ready. There's another, I think, linear model. They have different names for it. But it's mostly a model that says, you know, you need to be ready to be a tenant before we give you housing. So you have to have, you know, you have to be clean. You have to be actively participating in treatment. And these are all kind of like incentives to get you your house. So really that's what it is. It's treatment as an incentive. Whereas in housing first, you know, treatment is something that can come later. But housing in and of itself is a kind of treatment because you're there and now you're more willing to take care of yourself.
And we know the treatment doesn't work as well when you're not housed.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the first and last presentation, you all talked about some behavioral health issues, but you didn't talk about traumatic brain injury or military sexual trauma. Is that part of the data that you have available or something that you thought about adding to some of the studies?
You want to do it? So you wanted to know if there was any information on PTSD and
TBI.
So what we could do is go back and look at all the VA medical record data, and we could actually pull all their diagnoses and look and see, you know, do they have a TBI diagnosis? Do they have, you know, a PTSD related to a sexual trauma? Those are things we can look at later on when we look at that service utilization and the outcomes. And the tricky thing with TBI is it's not always diagnosed. So we, unless it's actually in their medical record, we're not going to know if they actually have an injury.
Well, the other thing that is a little bit tricky about TBI, right, and Lindsay, you would know from working on the TBI study, is that a lot of people have TBIs that might be unrelated to their military service as well, so it's a little bit different. I mean, just from one of those, you might be able to say better than I would about that.
And I talked to all men, so it's probably different, but most of their injuries were not military related. They were from being in the street and having to defend themselves or being drunk or something like that, and they just, you know, got injured.
Yeah, two things I'd add to that. TBI is a big issue among homelessness, and it's kind of underrecognized. And also, the services available to vets with service-connected TBI are also quite extensive, which tends to keep people out of homelessness. Tends to be a protective factor. It's because there are services and things available. So, and the research we do at the National Center is mainly administrative data, mainly secondary data sources, and so we're kind of dependent on, you know, the way it's assessed by other people. And TBI is a complicated diagnosis to make, so we have very low numbers of TBI that, frankly, I don't think any of us really trust. And with MST, with military sexual trauma, the data among veterans is that among women that really increases the risk for homelessness. Again, it's not something that's traditionally been measured. It's also something that I'm sure, as you know, is very underreported. So there's a lot of limitations to the data that we have, and hopefully that'll get better as this problem becomes more recognized.
When you were doing your presentation, so homelessness is a new issue for me. I'm from the North Carolina Institute of Medicine, we're not from the National Academy, and just completed a study on behavioral health in the military, comparing our VA services and public services in the state available to our returning veterans. I'll talk in the next session about collaboration among future organizations. But my thought, and because I don't know a lot about homelessness, this may be naive, but when you were talking about the people that don't have overlap between their veteran status, is it possible that when they try to apply for VA services, that they were in a higher income bracket and were not allowed into the VA for financial reasons, but as they fell into homelessness, then would be able to qualify for VA services?
Yeah, that's a possibility. No idea, you know, what the extent of that is. And that's something that's possible to find out. And that's on the benefits side. They keep records of, you know, people who apply for services and what the outcome is. So even though most homelessness among veterans, not surprisingly, occurs among those who've been in poverty, and so it's kind of a process more
more commonly than it is kind of a plummet into homelessness. So my guess is that's part of it, but it's not a huge part of it.
My understanding, and I think you might be able to clarify it, but I think I believe the vouchers, once they're funded, they're always there. That's why sometimes Congress doesn't like to give more vouchers sometimes, because they know it's always going to be on their books. A lot of the veterans don't, you know, stay indefinitely in HUD-VASH. They usually leave after 2 years, and a lot of them can transition into kind of their own housing. Or they transition off of a HUD-VASH voucher onto a regular Section 8 voucher by HUD once they no longer need the case management from the VA. But there are some movements to kind of limit the vouchers a little more, maybe have vouchers for people who don't need them as long. But when you're talking about the chronic homelessness, they're not going to just turn it all around to be completely financially independent within a year. You know, you've got to keep supporting them, but it's still cheaper in the long run to do that than to put them on the streets and have them coming into the emergency room every night and really eating up a lot of services that they wouldn't otherwise need.
And I'll put a plug in there, which is something we're working on in Texas and in Austin, is measuring and carefully measuring the time, the success rate, essentially, of transferring out of a service like a voucher program into stable housing or permanent housing without service support, and looking at reporting that to the community so that we can show, because it's not 100%, obviously. You get a lot of bounce back and recidivism and things, just like with any other treatment issue.
What are you guys finding, percentage-wise?
As far as what the results are? For transitional housing, it's somewhere around between 70 and 80%. We're moving that up to 85% this year.
85% what?
Transitional housing into stable housing. And then permanent supportive housing is a lot better. It's somewhere around 90%. But measuring that as an outcome for programs at the end of permanent supportive housing, just annually, to see, are they staying in, are they going back, returning to homelessness, or are they moving into self-sustained housing as a measurement.
And that's pretty much what the research is at. I mean, nationwide,
right,
about 85% retention rate for these supportive housing, for permanent supportive housing. So the idea is to kind of get enough units out there so you can kind of accommodate the turnover, so that 15% kind of matches the demand for people coming in. And you also, I mean, permanent supportive housing isn't for everybody. It's expensive. And it's also permanent. So, you know, this is a long-term financial commitment. And so you want to have other kind of more short-term, less services-intensive options for people who don't need those kind of services, for people who aren't that disabled, for people with prospects of